Welcome to this reading by Bernardine Evaristo and Ali Kobi Eckermann. They're going to read one after another. I'm going to introduce them separately, and at the end we should have time for some questions as well. Bernardine Evaristo is the author of 7 books. She's also an editor, critic, dramatist, and essayist. Her writing spans the genres of prose novels, verse novels, a novel within verse, a novella, poetry, non-fiction, literary criticism, and radio and theatre drama. Her latest novel, Mr. Loverman, is about a 74-year-old Caribbean London man who's a closet homosexual. Her writing is characterized by experimentation, daring, and the subverting the myths of various Afro-diasporic histories and identities, and she's published in a wide variety of publications and anthologies. In 2005, she approached Arts Council England with her concerns about the lack of publishing opportunities for poets of colour. They responded by funding the Free Verse report produced by Spread the Word, which highlighted the lack of diversity in British publishing and was given a platform in the influential Free Verse debate at the South Bank Centre. The actual figure for poets given in the report was so shockingly low, less than 1% of poetry published by major presses in the UK is by black and Asian poets, that it was clear that an urgent response was required. She then initiated a national development programme for black and Asian poets, The Complete Works, taken forward by Spread the Word. 2 anthologies have emerged from the programme, 10, which she edited with Daljit Nagra and was published by Blood Axe with Spread the Word in 2010, and 10, The New Wave, which is a sequel anthology featuring the work of 10 mostly younger poets, edited by Karen McCarthy-Wolf, to be published by Blood Axe with The Complete Works and launched with another high-profile debate at South Bank Centre at the beginning of October. She's the editor of 2 recent anthologies and a special issue of Wasafari magazine, Black Britain Beyond Definition, which celebrated and revaluated the black writing scene in Britain. In 2012, she was guest editor of the winter issue of Poetry Review, Britain's leading poetry journal, in its centenary year, and her issue, Offending Frequencies, featured more poets of colour than had previously been published in a single issue of the journal, as well as many female, radical, experimental and outspoken voices. She's guest editing the September 2014 issue of Ms. Lexia magazine, and she founded the Brunel University African Poetry Prize. She was born in Woolwich, southeast London, the 4th of 8 children to an English mother and a Nigerian father. That background informs her first verse novel, Lara. Her father was a welder and local Labour councillor, and her mother a schoolteacher, and she received an MBE in 2009. Please would you welcome Bernardine Evaristo.
Thanks very much for that introduction, Neil. And Neil has been part of this whole programme to get more poets of colour published. He didn't mention that, but he took part in the debate at the South Bank Centre in 2007, I think, and he's going to take part in one in October as well. It's great to be back at Ledbury, and it's great to be reading with Ali. I'm very excited about hearing her read her work. I'm going to read from Lara, which is the verse novel that Neil mentioned, which is based on my family history. And it's travels over 150 years and goes into both sides of my family ancestry and also looks at my experience of growing up mixed race in London in the 60s and 70s. So my mother is English, my father was Nigerian. But on my father's side, he was descended from Brazilian, originally slaves. And on my mother's side, she's descended from Irish and German people. So the book basically explores this history through loads of characters. It's semi-autobiographical, obviously, because I have to fictionalise some of it. And I just thought I'd see how far I get with taking you on a whistle-stop tour through some of the voices in the book. I'll begin with my father, who came to London and settled in the late 40s. And he's fictionalised here as Taiwo. But he actually arrived in Liverpool in 1949. He's writing to his mother. "Oh, Mama, your pride when I boarded the Apapa, your son, a man now, riding the whale to paradise. Remember the man's voice from Broadcasting House calling us over the airways from England? London calling the Empire, come in, Nigeria. I'm coming, I shouted at night into the warm winds on deck. Mama, my dreams have been my fuel for years. All those British films for sixpence at the movie house. See London, then die. I was desperate to get here. When I finally landed in Liverpool, it was heaven. I had hoped for snow, but it was just very cold. These people run everywhere and wear mufflers. Older cousin Sam came to greet me at the docks, just as well, because I thought the fast automobiles would kill me. I asked Sam if many people are killed by cars. He laughed. You will get used to life here. The Africans have European wives and sailors' children. Sam has a house in Princess Park in Toxteth District. His wife, Maureen, is Irish, and their six-year-old daughter is Beatrice. I said, why a white wife, Sam? He replied, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. Mama, I will write a letter soon, I promise you. Sam says this country is like fisherman's bait, Mama. It attracts, you bite, then you are trapped. I told him I'd be here 5 years, get my degree and leave. Tomorrow I head for London, center of the empire. Sam drinks stout every night, complaining that John Bull only gives him work on the railways. And I've met elders in the Yoruba Club in Croxteth Street who came in the last century as stowaways and seamen, fought in two world wars for Britain, but believe back home is paradise. I argue Nigeria is small time. Why eat rice and stew when you can taste Yorkshire pud, meat and two veg? You can buy anything here. There are so many shops, pubs on every street corner, and houses have all the modern conveniences. Many people are respectful, but some idiots shout, Oi, Johnny, Sambo, Darky, Nigger, at us. The elders tell us to take no nonsense from them. So if I am abused, I say quietly, just call me Taiwo, and boof, I fight them. Even the West Indians say, do you people still live in trees in the bush? Mama, in this country, I am colored. Back home, I was just me. So now I'm going to fast forward to Ellen, who's based on my mother, the woman he's going to marry. This is Abbey Wood, London, 1935. Back to her childhood. Her mother's called Peggy. That was my grandmother. Baby Ellen was the cherished, cuddled, coddled, much-loved child born to Peggy and Leslie Brinkworth. Pampered with soaps, creams, powders, babyhood was a perpetual playpen of squeezy, squirty, squeaky, soft, fluffy, and furry things. Nursery rhymes seduced her to sleep. Tinkering bells roused her awake. Oohs, ahs, and ahs followed her every movement. After 7 years of a scrimping and saving courtship to purchase a new house, cash down, £560, and furnish it, the wedded two were overjoyed with their reproduction, ensconced each morning, horizontally gurgling, to take air in her black bassinet perambulator in the garden. At number 31 Manton Road, in the new town of Abbey Wood, Peggy, slight of build, slight of hand, mind revolving like a spinning jenny, was bent all hours over her noisily whizzing sewing machine until her vertebrae stiffened and the usually punctilious stitches ran into themselves. When Peggy lifted her screaming infant to becalm her, she felt no dividing line between their warm bodies. Mother and daughter were seamlessly inseparable. She knew their paths would be overlocked forever. This is Peggy's voice. I pour dreams onto Ellen like syrup on treacle tart. She's growing up a real lady with her bows and ruffles. Her manners are impeccable. She minds her P's and Q's. There are no temper tantrums in public or private and no playing in the street. She's not common. A little on the clumsy side, she's given to stubborn moods, but I'll iron that out of her over the next 2 years. She's at St. Saviour's Primary now. Then she'll pass the 11 plus, get a scholarship to St. Joseph's Private Grammar in Erith, then university, God willing, and a successful career. I'm one of life's triers. I don't give up. My home is spotless. A quick flick with the duster each morning keeps dirt down. Then a thorough going over of a Saturday gets at the invisible. I detest sloppiness. There's not a thing out of place in number 31. From the bay window in my living room, I see 90 degrees of clear sky. In summer, at sunset, it's so beautiful. the purples, reds and golds, all smouldering like a coal fire. If you work hard, your dreams do come true. I'm proof. But the neighbours are a bind. They're a nosy lot. As soon as I step outside, nets start twitching. But I'm no cause for complaint. I make sure my windows are as spotless as anybody's. Now this is going back to Ireland. So this is now Emma, who was my grandmother's grandmother. Emma was delivered into her mamai's dying arms in a damp cottage in the frozen wasteland of winter, just as the reign of the great hunger was coming to a close. Its monster jaws had ravaged the island for four murderous years, masticated the emaciated bodies of a million poor souls, sucked the flesh off them, and buried their bones in earth, blighted with potatoes rotting with black and green mould. Britannia, the Protestant conqueror, who'd long ago throttled Catholic Hibernia between her two mammoth hands and stamped it to the ground, did little to help, inventing scapegoats instead. Ireland is a human swinery, an abomination, a black howling babel of superstitious savages. Like Widow Caitlin, who raised her grandchild Emma in the iron crook of her arm, who'd lost five daughters to the hunger, her husband to typhus, her only son Lorcan to the exodus to find work overseas. But oh no, not she. Caitlin swore to the good Lord that she would raise at least one grandchild in her beloved homeland, and she made young Emma swear on the Holy Bible never, ever to abandon Ireland. Emma eventually falls in love with an Englishman, a soldier. The miracle of his wet tongue in combat with mine, his moustache scratchy as sand used to scour pans, big brass buttons pressing into my breastbone. I could see bits of myself melting in them. Private Henry Robbins was a handsome man. His hardness made me feel so soft and spongy. My skirts and drawers spread about me like petals. My bones were blazing coals, my blood molten. His fingers parted my plaits, then curlicued my hair. The night's cool breath caressed my nakedness. My butterfly breasts were touched for the first time. His skin peeled off, wrapped around mine. My brain had grown wings and flown to the moon. No one had ever told me the exquisite pleasure. How could something so delicious ever be so wrong? The speed at which he unbuckled without fumbling, he slid into me, and when I opened my eyes to scream without sound, there, standing high above us, erect as the tall statue of Oliver Cromwell in town, was Mamo, monstrous against the royal blue sky, high-necked, arms crossed. She shook her head and worked her lips. Filthy, turncoat, whore. So they eventually come to London, which is where my grandmother's born. Going back to my mother now, she goes home to tell her mother that she's dating a coloured gentleman. Oh, he's not too dark, is he? Peggy grimaced. Pass the butter, dear. Don't slouch. Goodness knows I've told you enough times. You'll end up like the hunchback of Notre Dame. Where did this Tayo Woyo spring from, then? And what did you go there for? What's wrong with the Strawberry Hill boys or nice Stephen Brown from church? Of course, John McBride is ideal, but he's off to a seminary soon. Such a waste. At least you've put this nun nonsense on the scrap heap. A nun, indeed. So where does Tuya Mia hail from? All right, Taiwo. Oh, he calls himself Bill. Well, that's better. A native from a colony. Good Lord, so he is dark. Have you no sense of morals? Look, Ellen, I'm not one to interfere in your affairs, but you must discontinue this liaison immediately. Do you understand? Good grief, whatever next. Now, I've baked you a Madeira cake to take back to college, and I'll run off a summer dress for you this weekend. I got the pattern out of Woman's Weekly on Thursday. You'll need a fitting, though. I've noticed a pudding bulge appearing. I don't know where you get it from. Must be your father's side. Now, off you pop while I do the dishes. I don't want you under my feet. So, Ellen continues to date Taiwo, and Peggy gets increasingly hysterical. Two veiled alabaster Madonnas reside as mantelpiece sentinels on resolute marble, averting pupil-less eyes from the scene being drawn out by Peggy. Ellen, you'll not marry him. But I love him, Mummy. You must love me more. Silence hung with the green velvet curtains. The Victorian grandmother clock clanged 8 hours. The voluptuous sofa prepared again to comfort a tearful Ellen into cushioned arms. Peggy marched the loomed floor. Her stride considered the matter over, but Ellen's tiny voice hummed the warm furnishings. "I love him, Mummy, and I want to marry him, that's all." Peggy spun round. Her voice sliced the air like a scythe. "That's all! That's all! After all I've done for you! Do you think I'm going to let you ruin your life by marrying a darkie, a nigger man? You silly girl! I have sacrificed my whole life for you! How cruel! How could you do this to me, your own mother?" Peggy gulped a scream down, balled fist to open mouth, a Greek tragedy mask, then fled the room, stomped upstairs, slammed her bedroom door and bawled the house down. Peggy's duck pillows become ponds when Ellen visits. Her nighttime sobs are an overflowing bath. Journey from the master bedroom to her daughter's own, seep steadily under the door like an army's advancing front line, then crawl up her blanket to claim her. Ellen knows the ritual. First, her mother derides Taiwo's existence. A volley of machine gun invective ensues. Finally, deflating, she becomes a sodden, spineless vessel, brimming with tears, pleas, and cajoling. Her pain, a hive of frightened bees at Ellen's heart. Faith is the spinal cord which keeps the girl sane. Were they not all God's children? How very silly. Why such fuss because of colour? She barely noticed it. Other times, the hoo-ha she caused exhilarated her, for she, who had never put a foot wrong in her life, was finally, unequivocally, shamelessly being naughty. A solution to the problem popped into her head as she McLeaned her teeth one histrionic morning. Her mother should meet Taiwo, see how nice he was. After all, she'd never even met a coloured person. But Peggy beat her to it. "Bring him to tea," she shouted upstairs. "And how many wives do you have, Bill?" A pyramid of trimmed and quartered sandwiches separated Peggy's high collar from Taiwo's blue-tied Adam's apple. Cheddar cheese lay guillotined on a thin slice of oak tree. Exposed lettuce, sliced tomatoes and slaughtered carrot were crisscrossed with a filigree of Heinz salad cream. Taiwo sipped tasteless piss water from a midget's cup, gripped his back teeth like a pestle grinding corn in a mortar, smiled mechanically at the diminutive devil opposite. Peggy added, "And what do you do exactly?" "I'm a welder now, but I'm saving my money to study." "Oh." Her elongated vowel suspended itself over the table like a full colostomy bag. It was the O she'd learnt from the Lardidars years ago. Omnipotent, it hovered long after the speaker had gone. Ellen blurted out, "Taiwo can quote Shakespeare and Shelley." Peggy's head revolved like a ventriloquist dummy. Her eyes mocked Ellen as if she was completely bonkers. "She does not see me," Taiwo thought, "only a coloured." Leslie, Ellen's father, cleared his throat, the throttle of a car starting. Taiwo looked curiously at this blank page in the story. "I don't care where you're from, just look after my Ellen." Peggy snapped a digestive. Ellen restrained a giggle. Taiwo's shoulders dropped 4 inches. "Beautiful. I will remember his words until the day I die." And now I'm just going to give you a quick taste of Louis Vilkening, who was my mother's great-grandfather, who came from Germany in 1860 and settled in Woolwich, where I grew up. Louis Vilkening felt like a Teutonic titan, a warrior colossus bestriding the seas as the Friedhelm, which had brought him safely from Hamburg, sailed down the Thames towards the port of London. He stood up on deck, where he also slept, as the city where he would make his fortune came into view. Louis carried youth and hope, impatience, and a knife used to slaughter pigs and slit the throats of chickens, and he wore clogs carved by the village cobbler out of a limb of birch found on his dead father's farm. But no jacket, for he had sold it on board to buy bread. No coppers weighing down the pockets of his trousers. No photographs of family, for none had ever been taken. No plans to write back, for he had never held a pen. No English words except hello, goodbye, and how you are. No doubts about the future, when starvation was the past. When the Friedhelm dropped anchor at Royal Victoria Dock, so too did his heart. There was no looking back. A young outlander, determined to conquer England, Louis rolled up his sleeves to look for work. He becomes a master baker, gets married, and then at the First World War, he's victimised by the English. And this is him at the end of his life, Plumstead, which is in Woolwich, near Woolwich, London, 1920. "I am a man, not a nation," Louis was given to say on the rare occasion he had conversations. He took to playing Wagner so loud the neighbours complained, but he didn't give a damn about them, playing Ride of the Valkyries over and over again. At number 63, Griffin Road, the curtains were closed. He sat in the parlour, puffing on his Philet St. Omer pipe, buried in mountains of smoke. His once erect back curved and shrank, and his lungs struggled to expand. His grandson, Leslie, visited after school to sit with the man who had once saved his life, who told him to treat people as singular, not plural, and to play his chest close to his cards. Louis never spoke of how his son Frederick had hung himself soon after coming home from the trenches, how shell-shocked Arthur still couldn't find work, nor Harry, who lost his fishmongers when he signed up. A year after the Treaty of Versailles was signed, Louis was buried in a plot next to Gladys in a corner of Woolwich, which would be forever foreign. And then just finishing off, this is Lara. 1962, Eltham, London. "I shot into creation, a sperm from my father's penis, slept in my mother's womb for 8 months and 10 days, then slid out her dilated hole as if on a muddy slide. My entry to this island was messy, impatient, and dramatic. I was born May 28, the year 1962, when England was fast asleep and the moon rose, a luminescent sickle in a sky of heaving indigo waves. When a gloved hand smacked my wrinkled bum, I bawled air into activated lungs, grieving the sea I'd left behind. They named me Omolara. The family are like water. And my crumpled mother wept joy at my perfection, for amid all the soup, snot and cord, I was proportioned, 2 arms, legs, eyes, 1 nose, 10 fingers and toes. My frayed father expelled smoke on the quiet landing, while the midwife mopped my dishevelled mother. Juliana, Ginevra and Quentin, my siblings 3, snoozed in pastel cots upstairs, innocent of my determined arrival. I entered this world with everything, nothing, and as one who feels watched every second, every minute, every hour." So that's her birth. And this is Lara when she's 19 years old. "Fury rolled me, a wild buck jumper. I scalped myself, sacked Josh, speared my nose. My little afro ears coiled a sea of silver earrings. I barricaded myself into an army surplus trench coat and fronted a permanent, desperate Dan scowl. Nuggets of disease erupted on my surface. Squidgy, pus-filled hillocks splattered my bathroom mirror. I denounced my patriarchal father, deconstructed my childhood, regurgitated appropriated ideas like closing time vomit. I flirted with Sensi, swooped on trendy markets for cowries, batiks and sculptures. I was a walking, irradiated, automated diatribe, saw the rapist in every om, worms in every phallus, the bigot in all whites, the victim in every black woman. London was my war zone. I sautéed my speech with expletives, detonated explosives under the custard arses of those who dared detour from my arty political dictates. I divorced my honky mother, rubbished the globe for its self-destruct sins, and then flung open the Hammer House gates of my Rocky Horror Hades and tossed the key." Just as well you didn't know me then. Thank you very much.
Ali Cobby Eckerman is firmly established as a strong and vital, emotive voice within Australian Aboriginal literature, and she's one of the most remarkable poets to emerge in recent Australian poetry, and certainly the first Australian Aboriginal poet we've had the privilege of hearing at Ledbury. I first came across her work when I was in Australia, and the poet Robert Adamson showed me her poem Intervention Payday, which had just won an award, and he then included it in his anthology Best Australian Poems 2009. And Adelaide's first British publication came when I included that poem in my anthology Being Human, which, as it happens, was reviewed by Bernardine Evaristo in The Times. Although whether this counts as tellingly or not, in view of what we've been saying, the comments she made in that review about Ali's poem were cut by the paper. Ali is one of the stolen generations. Born on Corner Land near Adelaide in 1963, she was taken as a baby and adopted into the Eckermann family. Although the Lutherans who adopted her were loving, she faced racism, violence, and sexual and physical abuse in the small town where she grew up. Over time, she succumbed to a life of alcohol and drugs to help numb the pain and confusion of not knowing who she was. But after reconnecting with her birth family when she was 34, she found her way to wholeness. She regularly visits her traditional family in rural and remote South Australia to learn and to heal. After nearly 30 years in the Northern Territory, she now lives in the intervention-free village of Coolunga, South Australia, where she's renovating the old general store and establishing an Aboriginal writer's retreat. And she's currently researching Aboriginal massacres in South Australia. Her first book of poetry, Little Bit Long Time, was published in 2009. Her poetry reflects her journey to reconnect with her Yankuti Jajara Kokatha family. She's since published two verse novels, His Father's Eyes in 2011 and Ruby Moonlight in 2012. Another book of poems, Love, Dreaming and Other Poems, 2012, and an autobiography, Too Afraid to Cry. Her books have won many literary awards in Australia, and there are copies at the back of Ruby Moonlight and Too Afraid to Cry. You won't get them anywhere else in Britain. This is your only chance to buy them, so do snap them up at the end. Finally, something here about what Ali said when she was asked why she writes. She said, "I guess I write for both my families and for my ongoing healing that I need in my life. Mostly, though, for the Aboriginal audience. It is my biggest thrill when they attend any forum to hear my words. I've been amazed at the reaction from the wider Australian and international audiences to my poetry, which encourages me to keep writing too. Poetry has been the tool to assist my adopted family to understand some of the change that occurred deep within myself. I often say poetry saves lives." Would you please welcome Ali Cobby Eckermann?
Thank you, Neil. It is when the sudden silence of a baby's cry lingers, framed in an empty window, then the mother knows for sure more than breast milk will dry up today. And when the slow Spinifex touch of your mother's hand is severed from the sandhill of your cheek, then harshness and ridicule become the new seductions. And when your own born child is whisked from outstretched longing in a tendril of smoke to the sky, then how do you ever trust the universe if you cannot trust the womb? My name is Nyalu Winnie Alinya Kobi Eckermann, Nyalu Wallacher Yankandara. I'm an Aboriginal person from Central Australia. My language group is Yankandara, which is very remote desert country south of Uluru. I'm a survivor of the stolen generations. My mother didn't grow up with her mother. I didn't grow up with my mother. My son didn't grow up with me. We managed to find each other and spend some years together before my mother died. Despite all the cultural humour, the love that exists, the absolute love that exists in my culture, the fun we have chasing a bush tucker, there's a really sad legacy that we still suffer in Australia, and that's what I write about, to try to get more Australians to understand what what we need to change. As part of my cultural protocol, I would like to acknowledge the original peoples of this country and thank the spirit of this land for allowing me to tell my story. When you went back to the waterhole and sat under the mulberry tree at the All Deer Soakage, did you see Daisy Bates, dressed in English attire, standing on the white sand dunes? When you went back to the waterhole and scooped the precious water from the sandy sanctuary, did you see the warriors dancing in the moonlight, snake and emu making love? When you went to the waterhole, do the white sand dunes make love to the moonlight? Does the mulberry tree scoop the precious water? Does Daisy hear the warriors coming back, coming back? My mother was born at All Deer Mission, and that's where Daisy Bates, she was quite an eccentric English anthropologist. She lived out there for 17 years documenting my family. It's also the site, just south of the site of Maralinga, where the British did their atomic bomb testing in the 40s, 50s and 60s. So my mother was four when the family had to flee across the desert for safety, and leaving those traditional lands and arriving at the mission started that three-generational stolen generation. Oh, come on. Sit down in the dirt and brush away them flies. Sit down in the dirt and notice the many eyes. I never done no wrong to you, so why you look at me? But if you got to check me out, well, go ahead, feel free. I feel that magic thing you do. You crawl beneath my skin to read the story of my soul, to tell me where I've been. And now, yous mob, you make me wait, so I just sit and sit. English words seem useless. I know language just a bit. I sit quiet way, not lonely, because this country sings loud songs. I never been out here before, but I feel like I belong. It's 3 days now, the mob comes back, big smiles are on their face. This your grandmother's country here, this is your homeland place. We got a shock when we seen you. You got your nana's face. We was real sad when she went missing in that cold Port Pirie place. I understand my feelings now, tears push behind my eyes. I'll sit on this soil any time and brush away them flies. I'll dance with mob on this red land, Munda Wirral place. I'll dance away them half-caste lies, because I got my nana's face. I was born Yunkundurra. My mother is Yunkundurra. Her mother was Yunkundurra. My family is Yunkundurra. I have learnt many things from my family elders. I have grown to recognise that life travels in circles. Aboriginal culture has taught me this. When I was born, I was not allowed to live with my family. I grew up in the white man's world. We lived in a square house. We picked fruit and vegetables from a neat fenced square plot. We kept animals in square paddocks. We ate at a square table. We sat on square chairs. I slept in a square bed. I looked at myself in a square mirror and did not know who I was. One day I met my mother. I began to travel. I visited places that I had already been, but this time I sat down with family. We gathered closely together by big round campfires. We ate bush tucker, feasting on round ants and berries. We ate meat from animals that live in round burrows. We slept in circles on beaches around our fires. We sat in the dirt on our land that belongs to a big round planet. We watched the moon grow to a magnificent yellow circle. That was our time. I have learnt two different ways now. I am thankful for this. That is part of my life circle. My heart is round, ready to echo the music of my family, but the square within me remains. The square stops me in my entirety. I can't stop drinking, I tell you true, since I watched my daughter perish. She burned to death inside a car. I lost what I most cherish. I seen the angels hold her as I screamed with useless hope. Can't stop drinking, I tell you true, it's the only way I cope. I can't stop drinking, I tell you true, since I found my sister dead. She hung herself to stop the rapes. I found her in the shed. That rapist bastard still lives here, unpunished in this town. Can't stop drinking, I tell you true, since I cut her down. Can't stop drinking, I tell you true, since my mother passed away. They found her battered down the creek. I miss her more each day. My family blame me for her death. Their words have made me wild. Can't stop drinking, I tell you true, because I was just a child. So if you see someone like me, who's drunk and loud and cursing, don't judge too hard, because you don't know what sorrows we are nursing. This one's for my brother. He was the first of my generation to pass away, and he was a drinker and a beggar on the streets. And when he passed away, I realised that he had taken the extended family tree with him. He knew it all in his memory, and it had never been written down, and we'd just taken that for granted. And it was a very, very strong lesson to learn that everyone, doesn't matter what their circumstances are, has a gift that should be honoured. I've written this in the style of haikus, but because sometimes I get really cross in Australia, I substituted the H for an F. I drink in the street, ask for money each day. Intolerance is free. When I pass away alone under the bridge, weeds grow in your mouth. A pauper's gravesite, dead flowers bent backwards, broken by neglect. Kurumpa wea palacha, walacha kuchu, ka na kulunpa, nananina walacha anka, ka na pukarinkula, nailu wachi. Wanti katini naikul walacha, nailu wachupa kulani, nailu wachilarinili walachikul, wama chikara, nailu reverse chachamilani naikul walacha, manu nailu ilara, nailu tungani naikul walacha chida, kurumpa wea palacha, walacha kuchu. There is no life but family. When I am young, I live with my family. When I grow up, I leave my family. When I am lonely, I miss my family. When I am drunk, I reverse charge my family. When I pass away, I unite my family. There is no life but family. There is love in the wind by the singing rock, down the river by the ancient tree. Love in kangaroo, goanna and emu. Love when spirit speaks, no human voice. At the sacred sites, eyes unblemished, Watch wedge-tail eagle soar over hidden water. Find the love. Life is extinct without bird song. Dream birds arise at dawn. Message birds tap windows. Guardian birds circle the sky. Watcher birds sit nearby. Fill my ears with bird song. I will survive. Every time we argue, I grieve the loss of you. You are leaving. There will be no farewell kiss at the door. You are returning to your country and probably your ex-wife or the wife before that or the wife before her. Your children will tell you things. They didn't like me. I wasn't good enough for you. I was. At the sink he says, gee, says you stolen generation mob, you're really affected. We was only arguing whose turn to do the dishes. I've been writing some new poems since I've been travelling. And this is one of them. My mother screams as I touch her hair, attempting to brush away the coarseness with my hands, to entwine twigs full of leaves into her locks, a tiara of green to soften her face. And our tears dry now, my mother is frailing. She talks only to those who have gone before, no longer seeing my love, no longer needing. And the wailing bursts from her mouths as she sinks to the ground, her mother, the earth, my mother, the dying. She throws sand in her face, tasting the grit in her mouth and wailing louder, throws herself forward, pushing her breasts into the softness of the earth, her mother. And my mother, the dying, crawls down into that final embrace, her conversation incoherent now, as if like a child she is practicing words for the lifetime to come. And the syllables loud and guttural spill over the sand, her mother, the earth. And I walk away, leaving her there in that cradle, safely nestled in the roots of that tree, safe in her country, our solace, her grave. And she just knew that one day she would fall asleep under the blanket that she carried everywhere as a veil from the evils of the world. And she just knew that the blanket would be decorated with a lap rug that her son tucked around her so he could hold her one last time. And she just knew that her daughter would just know when to come, to dislodge the cup of tea grown cold from the stiffening of her fingers and brush her hair. I'm going to read a series of poems from Ruby Moonlight, the verse novel that happily has won me some awards and financed my time to write. I wrote this. I got a glimpse of this story from sitting down the river at Kalunga when I first left the desert and left Tichikala, where I was living, when the intervention came. I was very lonely because I'd been on such a big journey and I'd found my Aboriginal family who were living still traditionally in the desert. And I was working as the arts centre manager, and I thought that was my home forever. But the intervention policies were so cruel, and I emotionally wasn't strong enough to stay and watch the people that had saved my life being treated so terribly. So I went to Kalunga, and I used to go down and where the sun first hit the ground in the winter time, I used to go and sit there with the dog and imagine that the old people were there. And in the course of doing that for many months, I got a glimpse of this story. And I wrote this this novel called Ruby Moonlight to give voice to the survivors of the massacres. They're littered everywhere in Australia. I've worked for Indigenous Youth Literacy, and we used to just travel. I did that for 2.5 years to all different remote communities right across Australia. And again, as is my protocol, I would meet with the elders so they could help identify the young people in that community who were interested in writing. And every time I sat down with the elders, the first story I heard was their local massacre story. So when I read this, I never thought it would be published in Australia, let alone being recognised and given awards. In warm afternoon light, a family group rove the plains, murmur delight as landscapes become familiar. Parrots surge their welcome at the old meeting place. A young woman gathers wild fruits and berries. Her husband, the spear maker, admires her supple body. Dancing a parody of love, his older brother teases his idolism. His own wife is still lithe, an aged law holder, the young woman, her only child. In the shade of gum trees, the old woman sings clan songs. As the cooking fires begin, a wombat gifts his soul. Sated now, the women dissolve down a cryptic path. Under the moon's glow, gratitude and joy are danced. Ribbons of campfire smoke drift to a sunrise sky as people begin to rise. The spear maker squats by the fire, his weapons hardened over coals. He stands to stretch. His eyes turn to the hillside where earthen thighs hide a sacred spring. Three crows circle nearby. He can see the women hurrying back from the hidden pathway, their movements clumsy in haste. He can see his brother running from the ochre cliffs, signalling, "Get the spears ready." Fear in their eyes, the women whisper, "There is danger here." In gesture language, the old man signals, "Shh, the air is wrong." The old man and his wife hold parliament with magpies. Within the meeting circle, chatter is warbled with worry. The remainder of the tribe wait in the shadows. Their trust in tribal ways is absolute. They watch in silent, ready to flee. The meeting erupts in a birdstorm. Strange animals and pale men burst from the river. Hack, hack, hack. Hands, heads, hearts. The clan slaughtered. Dying, dying, dead. The ambience of the morning is ruined. The stench of death fills the air. Love will exist here no more. A young woman sits like rock, staring at her husband and mother, their bodies termed tombstone. Arid eyes silt with sand. Tears will no longer flow. Life is doomed to drought. Scrape the images from your eyes. Scrape emotion from your heart. Never tell a soul. On the setting sun, she turns to the shadows. O Kumana, O Kumanari. Senses shattered by loss, she staggers to follow birdsong. Chirping red-browed finches lead to water. Ring-necked parrots place berries in her path. Honey-eaters flit the route to sweet grevillea. Owls nest in her eyes. Crimson wattlebirds turn shades of green. Blue wrens turn camouflage brown. Pied butcher birds lay trinkets in her path. Grey fantails flutter a soft revival. Apostle birds flicker on the edge of her eyes. Emus on the horizon stand like arrows. The woman turns, follows the emus. Green and bright blue flits of colour swirl in a mallee grey underground amid constant birdsong harmony. Along the riverbank, bee-eaters dart rainbows around her head as she paints her body with yellow ochre, splash crimson on bleeding eyes through the tunnel of darkness, honour the dead. Might leave it there. Thank you. Now, we do this for the family back home. Thank you.
Stay up here for questions with the microphone. Okay. I'll just stand up on the stage and I'll do a thank you at the end.
Okay.
Would anyone like to ask any questions? Yes.
I just wanted to ask Ali, as you grew up in your European family, your English language was your first language, how old were you when you learned your own language?
I'm still learning my own language. It's been 17 years since I met my mother and probably 15 years since I returned to the desert. I'd lived out in the desert as a runaway teenager and in my 20s, sort of before the land was returned to the Aboriginal people. So I knew the country. And this time when I went back, the people were back in the country. So there's probably 15 years since I started listening to the language. I can understand it by listening to it. I can read it and I can write it. There's still maybe that little bloody square that prevents me from talking it more than I should. But that's high on the priority list. To become fluent in language. I've said to my son that in my final days, if I get the choice, that we will not speak English and that he's learning language too, and that in their final days we will just speak in language as my mother and her sisters have done.
Questions?
Up the top there, Neil.
Yeah, at the top, yeah.
I heard echoes of Banjo Paterson and Henry Lawson ballad style in a couple of your poems. Is this a typical Australian?
No. They've stolen the pulse of the country. It always was and always will be Aboriginal land. And when you sit out in really remote areas, you can't help but be affected by the pulse of our land, and I think maybe stole's a bit rough, but I think they would, everyone that goes to Australia that I've talked to in the last week says that they're really affected by the land, and so I think anyone with a poetic heart, their writing would be influenced by that great presence. The entire land is our church, and so it has quite a reverent feeling, and so we get really sad when today we don't have the power to stop the immense mining that's happening to our most sacred churches.
I was just fascinated by it. Can you tell us a little more about the sticks which you used at the beginning, or even do a bit more?
In the desert, we we live such a basic life, but it's a rich life. So it's only on the coastal, northern coastal regions that they have the didgeridoo, because that's where the white ants live, and they could hollow the logs for blowing. So traditionally the men sing and accompany their singing with the boomerangs, and we have the sticks, that's our music. The emphasis probably on the ceremony is the dancing and the singing. The singing's very rich. We come from very strong lyricists. And the pantomime, I think when I've been working in the schools in the UK, everyone sort of understands pantomime. So the dance was very animated, I suppose. And then it's just with that pulse rhythm again, I think, from the earth. Very basic, but very beautiful and strong.
Carl Selly, do you feel Nigerian or German or... Not Ellie. Sorry.
Bernadine.
Do you feel Nigerian or German or Irish or what? I'm quite curious.
No, I feel very British. I think I sound very British, don't I?
Yeah, absolutely.
But when I was growing up, it was interesting because I'm a second generation black British person because my dad was the first generation. So when I was growing up, I grew up in a very white area and we were sort of pretty much the only black family and I was the only black girl in my school and so on. So I had some identity issues, but I never really felt that I didn't belong, but I didn't feel that I wasn't British. And then it became part of the sort of national conversation in the 80s, especially around Maggie Thatcher, that black people should say they were British and they should claim it for themselves. And there was quite a lot of resistance to that. And I used to think, well, maybe if I go to Nigeria, I'll feel that I belong to Nigeria. I did go to Nigeria, and they called me Whitey in Nigeria. You know, Oyinbo. They do it with anybody who looks like they're from Europe or whatever. But I mean, Nigeria is a very interesting, fascinating, difficult in many ways country, but I definitely knew once I'd gone there, and I've been to other African countries, but Nigeria, obviously, because that's where my father was from, I definitely then knew that I didn't, you know, I couldn't settle there and that I didn't belong there. And then actually writing Lara was very cathartic for me because I was having to inhabit the voices of all the different people in my ancestry, especially my grandmother, who I knew very well and she loved us, but she was racist still, you know, until she died. And then the book ends actually with me saying that I am my ancestors and I am myself. So by the end of the book, I feel very British and the book actually has me flying back to Heathrow, to my home. But within that, I'm also black, I'm also mixed race, and I have this sort of multiple heritage. With the football, I was going to the other day, which I'm not a football fan, but I did watch it. I was like, whoever wins, you know. So it had to be, you know, it was Germany. Germany and Brazil. Yeah, not for me, really. Completely mercenary, yeah.
Well, I'm afraid we have to finish there, but before we do, I'd like to present you with our Ledbury bowls made at the Camden community to commemorate your visits.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Would you please thank them again?